What I want to do before I start is to draw your attention to an interesting article in yesterday's paper about the University of Alabama seeking a big tuition increase. And let me just read you the first few paragraphs. It says, the University of Alabama is asking trustees to approve steep tuition hikes, okay, despite the fact that it's going to be getting 17% more in state funds. University officials said the tuition raise is needed for Alabama to become one of the top institutions in the Southeast. And then they go on and point out that the change would include an 8.5% raise for in-state tuition, okay, up to around $5,200. And out-of-state students would face an even steeper increase, if this is approved, an increase of about 13.2% to over $15,000. Then they go on and talk about how Auburn, okay, is still the state's most expensive public institution, okay. So in a sense, Alabama might be playing catch-up. But what I want to point out is the following. What were they implicitly assuming about the demand for an Alabama education? Yeah, that the demand curve is inelastic. Okay? That is that this big increase in tuition, while it's going to discourage some enrollments, will not discourage enough to cause total revenue to fall. So it's an inelastic demand curve. The point being that a point I made yesterday, or I guess actually the day before, that state institutions, state-owned institutions, tend to price in the inelastic range, okay? You never find profit-maximizing entrepreneurs doing this unless they've made a mistake in estimating what their demand curve will be, okay? And this results really in a short-run waste of resources because the university becomes too big. Okay? If it raised tuition and got into the elastic range, quantity demanded would fall, enrollments would fall off, their costs, their total costs would fall, and these resources would be better used in other parts of the economy. Okay, so it's inefficient, but yet it's done continually. Now, why is that? Well, how would we explain that? Well, first of all, always ask the question, as I said yesterday, cui bono, who benefits from these low prices of subways and state universities and so on? Well, the administration. Okay. The people in charge, whose salaries depend on the size of their institution and the number of faculty in their institution, they certainly benefit. So the greater the enrollments are, the larger the institution is, the higher the salaries are, the more people under them they can hire. So in other words, it's called empire building. So they'd rather have a zero price, a zero tuition, okay, if they could get the state to finance all of the students that would come at zero tuition. Through taxes. Now, the politicians, why would the politicians consent to having lower prices when that means that they have to raise taxes to support the difference between the cost of educating the student and the tuition that's paid? Even after this raise in tuition by Auburn, there's still going to be a tremendous amount of tax monies coming to the university. Well, again, the politicians are seeking to be reelected, and people that they want to appeal to people that are vitally interested in a particular issue, okay, that is an issue that people consider to be a voting issue. So parents of and students who are voting age who are intending to come to the University of Alabama are vitally interested in having a lower tuition. So the benefits are concentrated on this smaller group in Alabama and outside of Alabama, but they don't vote, but a small group within Alabama, and who are willing to vote for people that will give them lower tuition. Whereas taxpayers in Alabama are a much larger group, right? And so the costs are dispersed and are smaller for each individual in this larger group who are victimized, okay, by these lower tuitions and higher levels of tax support, okay? So that's I think, an explanation of why consistently governments tend to price services that they provide in the inelastic range of their demand curve. All right, well, what I want to do now is to finish up the discussion began yesterday regarding case studies in price controls. And there was one other point I wanted to make about rent controls. Before I get into another case of maximum price controls, and that is, when you have a shortage, One other type of behavior that you begin to see among landlords is that they begin to rigorously enforce the lease. Okay, that's very interesting. Okay, in other words, if you rent an apartment and you read the fine print in the lease, basically you can't do anything after 10 o'clock at night except breathe in your apartment. You can't have overnight guests that are unrelated. You can't play the television, at any sort of volume or your stereo. You can't, for example, repair your car out in the parking lot or even wash your car in the parking lot. You may not be able to have pets. There are a lot of clauses in there. Now, these onerous clauses in the lease generally are not enforced on a free market, okay, where supply equals demand. They're usually in there to protect tenants, most of the tenants, from an unruly tenant who might have pets that he allows to roam freely and attack other tenants, or similarly his own children that are unruly and annoy other tenants, or people who are out there late at night, you know, fixing their cars and making a racket. So it makes it easier for them to evict, okay? If they were to actually enforce these sort of fascist provisions in the lease, they would experience a lot of vacancies, right? Because supply equals demand, people don't have to go to that apartment building, they'll find other apartments. So it's really competition that determines how rigorously the lease is enforced. Now, what happens, however, if there's a big shortage of apartments? People put up with anything, okay? I have had personal experience with this. When I lived in southern New Jersey, which is actually much more rural than northern New Jersey, in fact, part of it is below the Mason-Dixon line, believe it or not. And there's an interesting sign as you're driving down a highway, major highway that's going to southern New Jersey. There used to be a big sign with the top half of New Jersey more or less black and dripping sort of with oil, and the bottom half is emerald green, and it says, We don't want your industry, farmers of South Jersey. The people in South called themselves South Jerseyans. In any case, they were a real individualistic lot. After the wage and price control freeze that Nixon had imposed on the economy ended in 1975, many towns kept price controls, and many towns in northern New Jersey kept rent controls, for example. In southern New Jersey, they didn't. Okay, they just lapsed. So when I lived in southern New Jersey, I read the lease. I was teaching at a small school there. Read the lease, and it said you couldn't have pets. You couldn't repair your car in a parking lot. All of the usual things. And I had a couple of cats, so I was a little worried about it. And so one of my neighbors came over and said, "Look, don't worry," because I was trying to figure out how to hide them. She said, "Don't worry about it. They don't really enforce it. As long as your pets don't make a mess on the property and are quiet and so on, they're not going to enforce that part of the lease." And also, I would see people during the day out there washing their cars and so on and repairing their autos. So I figured, well, that's great. So a few years later, I get a job at Rutgers, which is northern New Jersey. I move up to northern New Jersey. There's still rent controls. And, so I have we have cats. So I had cats were out running around with the moving men, moving things in. And one of the neighbors came over and said, "You better hide those cats." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, because it's in the lease, if you look at it." And so I said, "Really? So they enforce it?" She says, "Oh, yeah." She says, "Not only do they enforce it, they had the manager of the complex had like a little Gestapo group of kids that ran around during the day and looked in people's windows and reported back on whether or not they had pets." So they begin, and then at night I would see people out there with flashlights, like fixing their cars and stuff, like, at midnight, that they'd be parked off in a corner of the parking lot. They were rigorously enforcing the lease, because if you didn't like it, you can leave. There's a shortage of apartments. There's someone else on the waiting list. Okay? So that's very interesting. And so what happens is that people with children, people with pets, people, as I mentioned yesterday, there's also, racial and religious discrimination. These types of people find it much more difficult to find apartments when you have rent controls and there are shortages. Okay, they can be easily turned away without the landlord suffering any sort of monetary loss. And to bring this home, I give my class when I teach this an example of it's not so politically correct anymore, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it. The lecherous landlord will only rent, let's say, the blonde females between 18 and 25. It's the only group he's going to rent to, okay? All right, so let's assume he can get $1,000. Let me put this up here. $1,000 per apartment per month for the apartment, okay? And let's say he has 20 units. And where there are no rent controls on a free market, where supply is equal to demand, let's say he would have 5 vacancies, okay? Because it takes a while to find exactly those that small group of people that he wants to rent to. Okay, so I'm obviously, you know, exaggerating this for effect. But so he indulges his preferences. Okay, if he indulges his preferences for you know, a certain group of people that he wants to rent to, what's going to happen? He has 5 vacancies, which means that he loses $1,000 a month. And in 1 year, that will work out to be times 12. Okay, so that will work out to be $60,000. He loses $60,000 in income if he wants to discriminate according to his preferences. Okay, now let's take a rent control situation where there's a huge shortage, such as New York City. Would he lose that? So in other words, the higher the cost, the less he's likely to indulge his preferences. He may very well, on a free market, not indulge it. Say it's not worth $60,000 to renting to old, pretty young females, okay, or whatever his preferences are. However, when there is a shortage and people are desperate for apartments, he can simply turn people away until he finds the people that he wants. So it's much less likely that it's much more likely that he'll indulge his preferences. Okay, he'll have many fewer vacancies. He might only have 1 or 2. If any, and so he won't lose much income, okay, especially if the rents are much below $1,000. So in other words, it's the law of demand operating. As the cost of renting to only a certain group falls, which it does under rent control, what happens? People are going to engage in more of that sort of activity, okay? So I think that's a good example that leads you to see that even in the case of preferences and prejudices, that rent controls have an effect that you don't really, or that no one who endorses them would find desirable. Okay, there was another article that I looked at, and I meant to discuss in more detail. But I'll briefly mention to you: in France after World War II, there were rent controls. And the French were paying in Paris something about equal to about $1 or 11 packs of cigarettes per month. That was the rent. The rent controls had been put in during World War I. They hadn't been changed. Needless to say, hardly any new building in Paris after World War I. Okay, so now we're talking 1946, 1947 after World War II. There was a massive shortage. The only way you could get an apartment was if someone died. So when the soldiers returned and they married and so on after World War II, they needed apartments because they were living with the in-laws, which isn't a great way to start a marriage. And so they needed apartments. So the full-time job of the wife, while the soldier went to work, or the former soldier, you know, was at work earning a living, was to go and sit in parks, okay, where old people congregated, and to focus in on the most sickly-looking older person, and then follow them home and find out, you know, where they lived, and then go to the landlord or to the superintendent and give them a big bribe and tell them, this is in exchange for letting me be the first one to know when that person dies. And then the landlord would let them know, and then he would help. It was basically, if you got there first, you got it. So as soon as the person died, you know, they'd be pushing the body aside, moving their furniture in. Okay. So no one in their wildest imagination believed that rent controls would lead to turning, you know, part of the population of France into ghouls, you know, just hovering around waiting for people to die, okay? But in fact, that's indeed what did happen. Yes?
Something sort of what they do in New York as well,
where people looking
in
the cherries
and go to
the
funeral.
Yeah, they showed that on
Friends. On Seinfeld. Yeah, this sort of behavior on a reduced scale also occurs in New York, as has just been pointed out, where people look in the obituaries to find the addresses of people that have died, okay? And then possibly even go attend the wakes and so on to meet the family so that they can pay them a bribe and get the apartment, okay? I don't know how, you know, I don't know if that's an apocryphal story, if that's true, but I do know that, you know, there's key money paid in New York where you pay it's illegal, but you can pay a non-refundable deposit for the key. The landlord says, well, you know, you got to give me $3,000 for this key, okay? And it's not refundable, and So they keep it. It's pretty transparent bribe. Okay. Well. Okay. Let me now talk about another case of controls, and that is organ donations. Okay, which people don't usually think is an issue, an economic issue, but in fact, it most definitely is. And I have an actual diagram with figures that are accurate, at least for 1995, I believe. Yeah, 1995. Let me see if I can get this centered and then focused in on. Okay. In 1995, the demand for, now, by the way, in 1984, let me just backtrack a moment. In 1984, in the United States, the Transplant Act of 1984 was passed, and it makes it a felony to buy or sell organs. Okay? So, in effect, that means that there is a zero price, P equals zero. Now, for family reasons or for altruistic reasons, people sign donor cards. Okay? Most of the organs that are transplanted are cadaveric. They come from dead bodies, okay? But there's a proportion of donations among family members, okay? So in the case of kidneys, there were 10,000 kidneys donated in 95, and yet 40,000 people needed transplants, were on a waiting list, okay? Regarding hearts, the numbers were 2,400 and 6,400, okay? What occurred, of course, was that some of those people between A and B, for both kidneys and hearts, died while they were on the waiting list. I have the numbers here. 731 of those waiting for heart transplants out of the 4,000 that didn't get them died. Okay, and for kidney transplants, out of the 30,000 patients on the waiting list, over 1,300 died. Okay, for lung and liver transplants, 290 and 674 patients died respectively while they were waiting for organs. Okay. Now, how did the government meet this crisis that, you know, had begun to develop since 1984? There was another reason why it began to develop, because in 1986, cyclosporine, a drug which was designed to inhibit organ and tissue rejection, was allowed onto the market. Okay. And there was also an increasing sophistication in tissue matching and in surgical techniques. So success rates for transplants dramatically increased. So you began to get a big increase in demand for transplants, but yet there was no big increase in the supply curve, okay, or even in the quantity supply, okay. So this is simply a shortage caused by a price control of zero. It's interesting, and, you know, and there's all ethical arguments. There's a number of ethical arguments against it. You know, why should an individual benefit from another individual's misfortune? Okay, you know, let's say the equilibrium price is $75,000 for a kidney. Okay, you know, so the attitude is, how dare someone accept $75,000 for a kidney? You know, that's taking advantage or exploiting someone else's misfortune. Well, let me put it to you the following way. Do the surgeons that participate in the transplants, do they get paid? Yeah, they sure do. Hospitals get paid? Do the drug companies that supply cyclosporine and other drugs get paid? Yes, everyone else that participates in the transplant surgery get pays. But no one raises any ethical questions about that. They're all getting paid as a result of this person's misfortune. In fact, anytime you go to a doctor, anytime you have any sort of surgical procedure, they're exploiting your misfortune. That's simply scarcity, okay? There's a scarcity of good health in the world, okay? So that ethical argument doesn't hold up praxeologically. Yes?
They've also had cases where
right. That's an interesting point Mila brings up. That is that in some places, if someone has a rare form of cancer, for example, or another rare disease, they'll take some of that person's tissue without informing the person of that and use it for experimentation. and you know, come up with new drugs and so on, and possibly a big sum of money from successful research. Yes. Right. So, and that person isn't paid, and that person is put up under for a longer period of time than he or she would be, and that impairs their immune system and puts them at more risk just to take this free tissue. Okay. So that's fine to do without if indeed that exists to inform people and to take a part of their body for. Even though it's not a vital organ for experimentation, but yet to pay someone who will donate the organ, who will sign a donor, will more people sign donor cards? Let's put it that way. What will happen to quantity supplied? Okay, if donor cards are permitted to be signed, or rather, if you can pay someone now to sign a donor card, which will then let's say embodies an agreement to turn over their organs to this organ bank after post-mortem, after they die, okay? Would more people do it at 10,000, 20,000? Of course. Quantity supplied increases, okay, as the price rises. And in fact, there's been surveys done. People's reluctance to designate themselves legally as organ donors can be attributed partly to procrastination, okay, I'll do it later, and partly to an anxiety harbored by some potential donors that, in the event of an accident, emergency room medical treatment might be less aggressive for accident victims whose driver's license are stamped organ donor, okay? In matters of one's own life, most people tend to be quite reluctant to take risks for free, okay? That's a fact of life. Would they overcome that reluctance at 50,000? Perhaps. More would overcome it at 75,000, okay? So what you would get then is a greater number of people, the difference between QE, okay, and QS, able to get transplants, okay? And you would have fewer deaths, okay? The people that do not pay the higher price aren't necessarily people that can't afford to. They may be people who have a very short life expectancy even with the donation and don't want to go through the discomfort associated with that donation, okay? Or they might be people that just don't like surgery and would rather stay on dialysis. But the point is, like any other good on the market, it's not the rich people that get all of the good. Okay, the rich people don't have all of the luxury cars. Some people will forego other things, some middle-class income people, or even lower-income people will forego many other things because a luxury car ranks highly on their value scales, or their family will help them purchase it, and so on. Okay, same thing is true with organs. Okay, you're going to have them distributed to those who value them highest vis-a-vis other goods and money on their value scales. There was one other point I wanted to make. Oh, predictably enough, a black market has, of course, grown up. And let me read you part of an article on this. They're talking about an individual. They say he was desperate for a kidney transplant, but getting a donated kidney, he was told, could take 10 years. That's when this individual's name is Moshe Tati. He decided to pay a broker $145,000 to buy a kidney, okay? And he said he was in terrible shape, and it didn't matter what it cost. You know, he wanted to live like a human being, as he puts it here. In any case, there are nearly now. This is a later article. This is 2001 or 2002 here. There are nearly 49,000 people in the United States waiting for kidneys, so the waiting list has gone up. The only major organs that can be wholly harvested from a living person. More than 2,500 Americans died last year waiting for kidney transplants. So the number of deaths have gone up significantly too, from 1,700. These numbers, along with desperate economic conditions in the third world, has given rise to a secret underground industry that is also fueling an explosive ethical debate. Yeah, the people that are debating it, are involved in the ethical debate, are people in academia, people whose organs aren't failing. Okay, they're the ones that are debating on whether this is right or not. Okay, within days of paying the $145,000. Tati got a call from the broker late at night telling him to come to Israel's Ben Gurion Airport. He and three other kidney patients were whisked onto a private plane, joined by a surgical team. They arrived in the Turkish city of Adana 2 hours later. The operations took place in a private hospital. The patients were brought in the back door. Tati only glimpsed the man who sold him a kidney. He was an Iraqi soldier who had defected and needed money. Okay, so the market is operating. Okay, the market's getting around all these government regulations. I mean, they're sending surgical teams on airplanes and so on. Okay, buying and selling organs is prohibited in almost every country, and yet it's happening almost everywhere. It says most of the people that are selling their kidneys are from poor countries. Okay. For example, in the former Soviet Republic of Moldova, one woman told ABC News she sold one of her kidneys for just $1,500. Okay, she did it to buy food for her children. Okay, and then they talk a little bit about the ethical debate. The idea that organs can be bought and sold used to appall Dr. Michael Friedlander, but then some of his patients started getting into the market. I'm seeing patients who were in dialysis treatment, says Friedlander. Some of them were in very bad condition and suddenly 2 or 3 weeks later coming back well transplanted, very happy, and a completely different state of health. So, you know, these aren't just back alley operations where people are dying from them. The market is providing here, even though it's a black market, at least in many cases, a service that is a service that is successful. It says most physicians and medical ethicists say that buying and selling kidneys is wrong, period. Okay, what does that mean? Is wrong, period. Okay, I mean, they take into account the fact that not only the people getting the money are benefiting, okay, but also the people getting the organs are benefiting. Okay, that the woman that gets the 50, it's interesting, it's really the poor that are always the good ones and the rich that are always the bad ones. So when a poor person sells an organ for $1,500, like this woman in Moldova, she's the exploited one, okay? The one that's selling the kidney, right? So it seems to me this is a physician talking. It seems to me a violation of the very nature of what medicine is about, explains Nancy Shepherd Hughes, to suggest that the poor should be allowed to dismantle themselves bit by bit with the help of the medical profession. They're hardly doing that. That's absurd, okay? How is it any different from Alex donating a kidney to a relative, okay? How's that different from a surgeon participating in that procedure from a surgeon participating in a procedure in which someone is selling the kidney, okay? So I'm not even making an ethical judgment on it. What I'm saying is that praxeologically that they can't establish a difference between the two. Okay, they're both voluntary. They're both done in a way that improves the utility of both parties participating, okay? Both donor and recipient and buyer and seller both are better off. Okay, whatever these ethicists, bio or medical ethicists think. Okay, now let me get into, and I'll go through fairly rapidly, the case of price floors. Okay, that is a case where the price is set below which it's illegal to sell the good. Again, I start off with a milk example, but I'll use a wheat example. And let me just zoom out on this. Okay. In this case, again, we're talking about gallons of milk. What happens is that Congress may pass a law that is designed to ensure that farmers have stable incomes, okay, to fix a price at which farmers can sell the product, let's say $8, and have stable incomes. Okay, incomes crops tend to change rapidly. There's a volatile supply in agricultural markets. That's usually one of the arguments that's used. Okay, to get the consumers to support these price floors, they'll say something like, "Well, you know, today milk is very cheap. It's $2." Okay. But that's so low that farmers are going to lose money and eventually they're going to go out of business. And then the price of milk is going to go up to $13 per gallon. And, you know, babies will be starving. They won't have milk. Okay? And then at that high price, the next year, there's going to be a lot more milk on the market to push the price down to $1. And more farmers are going to go out of business. And then the price will shoot up to $15. So there's going to be a disorderly market with prices shooting up and down. Okay? That's the argument that's often made to get taxpayers and other non-farmers to support consumers and so on, to support higher prices for milk. They say, look, at $8, farmers can earn a nice profit and they'll stay in the market and the price of milk will be stable, okay, from year to year. So that's an argument. Well, notice what happens here. You have all of the effects coming into play although in reverse, that you did with price ceilings. Okay, at $8, notice that there's a given stock of milk on the market initially in the short run, 13 million gallons per week, and people only want 7 million. Okay, so suddenly you have a surplus, right? And as that surplus builds, it hangs over the market. What can happen is that farmers have an incentive to start violating the law and selling the milk on the black market to get something for it. So the government will step in and say, all right, what we'll do is anything you do not sell at $8, we will purchase at $8. That's called a price support. We'll support the price by buying up the surplus at $8. Okay. Now, as farmers adjust to this over time, as dairy farmers adjust, what they begin to do is at $8, since it's profitable to produce milk, you get more people entering the industry and existing farms growing and increasing the supply of milk. So there's a long-run supply curve. So the surplus gets worse and worse over time. It grows, the supply grows from, let's say, 13 million gallons to 22 million gallons per day, per week. And so then now you have a huge surplus of milk, okay, the difference between 22 million gallons quantity supplied and quantity demanded of 7 million gallons. Right. So this is very costly. The government has to buy up the milk. And in milk programs that we have in the United States, farmers are forced to turn the surplus milk into butter and cheese, and then it's frozen, okay? It's stored and frozen. And then eventually, after 2 or 3 years, it will go bad anyway, so it's given away to... you often see these giveaways of free cheese and free butter and so on. It's giving away to poor people. Okay, and other things happen. For example, as more and more land is used in farming, let's say cattle farming, and more machinery and so on, the price of all of these things begin to go up. So the price of farmland rises, and the farmers benefit from that. Okay, now let me deal now with a real example here, or example I have more information about. And there certainly are milk price supports. And that example is the wheat, okay, the case of wheat. Okay, we have wheat price supports. Let me make sure I have this. Hold on 1 second. I don't need the diagram for the time being. What I'll do is I'll just put up the other diagram with the price flow. We'll use the wheat example. Okay. Wheat generally tends to be around $2 to $3 per bushel. And let's say the government sets a price support at $5, or we can use $8 as an example. So what you're going to get is, in the long run, you have this huge surplus of wheat. And the government's going to have a lot of pressure on it to deal with the surplus. For example, in the 1950s, what it tried to do was to give the wheat away to foreign countries in foreign aid. Okay, there was a law passed in 1954, Public Law Number 480, which identified poor countries such as India. So they began to sell it cheap or give it away free to India. Right. Now, notice what happens there. In India, local people buy food from their local farmers. Okay, they buy rice and other things. Now they're getting free wheat or very, very cheap wheat from abroad. So they begin to shift their demand, because they're rational, to the free or cheap food. And their demand for the local food from the local farmers, agricultural products from local farmers in India, falls. Now, what happens to those farms? They go out of business. Now, what happens in a year in which the U.S. has a bad crop, that is to say that the supply curve shifts back to, 7 million, and there isn't any excess wheat that the government has to get rid of? Well, then there's a famine in India. So after a while, the U.S. stopped these programs of giving direct, large quantities of food to third world countries, okay? So then they figured another way of doing it. Before that, they began to store the wheat in mothballed ships from World War II that were moored in the Hudson River, and they just left it there, and it rotted. And that became a political scandal in the late 50s, early 60s. Okay. Well, people are starving in the United States and around the world, and you're allowing all this wheat to rot. At one point, the Canadian government, to get rid of its surplus of eggs, permitted 28 million eggs to rot. Okay. So this politically does not look good. So you want to find another way to get rid of it. Well, you can give it away domestically to poor people. Right? So that's why we had programs such as food stamps, school breakfasts, school lunches, you know, free school breakfasts, free school lunches. It was to get rid of these surpluses. But of course, poor people also buy food. So what happened to the demand for the food? The demand for food shifted to the left because they were getting it free, and that increased the surplus. So government really, the U.S. government, was desperate to get rid of the surpluses. So one of the things they actually tried, there was a government scientist experimented with a technique to use wheat in place of gravel to mix asphalt. Of course, it failed abysmally, but for paving roads. They were going to use wheat in paving roads. Okay, that failed. So then, of course, you come to out-and-out monopoly. Okay, what you do then is to get rid of the wheat, the surplus, which is politically embarrassing, you forcibly shift the supply curve back. Okay, so you begin to tell farmers, you give them acreage allotments. You say, from now on, you can only devote 80% of your acres to wheat, okay, or 60%, or whatever it is. Okay, so you force them to restrict the supply. Now, a couple things happen here. Farmers are profit motivated, okay, their incentive is to earn profits as high as possible. When you do that, how are they going to respond? Well, they're going to take their worst acres out of production. So it's not going to decrease as much. It's not going to decrease, let's say you mandate 40% taken out of production, 60% acres remaining in production. The wheat output will not decrease by 40%, but by much less. So you're still going to have surpluses. Secondly, farmers are going to say, you know what? I'll just farm the 60% of the land that I'm permitted to farm with wheat more intensively. I'll buy more and better equipment, more fertilizer, and so on. So the supply curve again tends to creep to the right, okay, reestablishing the surplus. So then the government introduces market quotas, okay, and market quotas set how much the farmer is permitted to bring to market, okay. It's a straight cartel arrangement that farmers can't bring more than a certain amount per harvest to market. And that, they hope, will push back the supply to equal demand. Okay, farmers don't like this type of thing. In fact, some farmers rebelled against this. Some citrus farmers rebelled against this. There was a famous guy, he was a libertarian, who challenged the Sunkist cartel, okay, which is sort of a government-mandated selling cartel. Somehow Sunkist controlled it. And I don't think he won, all right? Then the farmers get deficiency payments if the prices fall. For example, allow the price to be set at the equilibrium, let's say $5 a bushel. The price falls below that, let's say to $3, well, we'll pay farmers $2 extra for every bushel they sell so that they have $5 per bushel. So there you get rid of the surplus. So there's other things to be said about this, but one thing I want to point out is that guess who benefits the most, large farmers or small farmers? The large farmers. First of all, just from the point of view of increasing the prices, okay, through these various schemes, if, for example, you have a farmer that is selling 100,000 bushels of wheat, okay, he's a large farmer, and you have another farmer, small farmer, selling 5,000 bushels, and let's say the government sets the price support at $5 and so that it's $2 higher than the $3 equilibrium price. Well, guess who gets $2 more per bushel? Well, they both do, actually. But guess who benefits more? Obviously, the large farmer earns $200,000, okay, of additional income. The smaller farmer earns only $10,000. Some people have called these farm programs welfare programs in reverse. Because what they do is they in effect, tax consumers, particularly those consumers who spend the largest proportion of their incomes on food. And who are they? Does the guy who earns $1 million a year spend a very large proportion of his income on food? Not likely. Okay? It's a guy who earns $20,000. So basically, you burden poor consumers with higher prices, you tax them, and then that money's redistributed mainly to large farmers, large wealthy farmers. That's why it's a welfare program in reverse. How do you get rid of all of these farm surpluses? Simply allow the market to operate. Get rid of all price supports. Right? Now, not only do we get screwed as consumers here, having to pay higher prices, right? But also as taxpayers, we have to pay for the deficiency payments, we have to pay to store the surpluses, and so on. So taxpayers and consumers in general lose, and farmers, especially wealthier farmers, are the ones that gain. Also, if the price of food were allowed, of things like peanuts and sugar and milk and wheat and cotton, okay, a non-food agricultural crop, if the price of these things were allowed to be determined by the free market, food and clothing would have a lower price, and so you wouldn't need food stamps, okay, or there'd be less of a justification, let's say, for food stamps. Oh, I was just going to show you the diagram of the wheat market. Let me just do that. Found it. Okay, so that's, let's put up a little further. Okay. There's a short run supply curve there. There's an initial surplus of 2 million, between 7 and 9 million bushels. Supply is 9. 7 million is the quantity demanded at $5. And over time, though, farmers expand, more people move into that area, and what you get then is an increase in quantity supplied to 11 million in the long run and a larger surplus. Okay. Okay. All right, let's move on to the next topic, which is on entrepreneurship, profits, and losses. So now we're moving away from price determination. We've shown how prices are determined and how government interference with price determination distorts the market and makes things less efficient. Now we want to talk about how prices guide entrepreneurs in making their production decisions. Okay? So much of economics is about production decisions made under the calculation that is permitted by prices. So the driving force in production is the entrepreneur, okay? And let me give you a definition of the entrepreneur. And then we'll talk about his role in more detail and about the role of profits. Now, remember, before we actually define the entrepreneur, remember that all action takes place under uncertainty. It's all aimed towards the future. In order to act successfully, people have to forecast the future. Okay, the more successful they are in forecasting the future, the more successful their actions will be. Okay, so that, therefore, there is always an entrepreneurial element in every action, okay, including actions in your daily lives and actions in business. Okay, so every action has an entrepreneurial element. So when you decide on a college major, okay, you are making an entrepreneurial decision regarding what you expect the salaries to be in that major versus salaries that you're going to be earning if you took other majors. Right? Or if someone moves from the Northeast to the Southeast thinking that the job market is better here and gets a job but then loses the job pretty quickly and can't find another one, that person has acted as an entrepreneur but has made an unsuccessful decision. Turns out the costs are greater than the benefits. So everyone acts as an entrepreneur, but when economists use the term entrepreneurship, we mean something much more specific. We don't mean the laborer making decisions that are risky or the landowner making certain decisions that are risky. We mean a specific individual, the promoter entrepreneur. Now, Mises calls him the promoter entrepreneur. Rothbard calls him the capitalist entrepreneur. We'll just call him the entrepreneur, okay? But keep in mind that when we're talking about the entrepreneur, we mean this narrower conception of someone who earns his or her income from allocating production to future needs or future demands, Okay. Or to put it another way, the capitalist entrepreneur is a person who attempts to take advantage of the fact that there's continual change in the economy and that resources, at any given moment of time, there are resources in the economy that are undervalued, that are not being used in their highest valued use from the point of view of future consumer demand. So that person seeks to earn a living from adjusting resources, from moving them from undervalued to higher valued uses. So what is the specific function of this entrepreneur? Well, this entrepreneur determines the employment of the factors of production. Okay, with his capital and investment in various lines of production, he is making decisions how to use the scarce factors out there in the economy. Okay? And all entrepreneurs compete against one another to get control of these factors of production. And that's what determines, as we'll see in the next lecture, determines the prices, wages, rents, and so on, of the various capital goods, labor, types of labor, and natural resources. Okay. Now, one thing to keep in mind, the entrepreneurial function, and I'll repeat this later on in more detail, is not a factor of production. The entrepreneur is not a factor of production. It's a pure decision-making function. It's a decision about how to use the factors of production. Okay? So it's an intellectual function. It's a purely intellectual function. Many books, almost all books, will say that, well, entrepreneurship is a type of labor, therefore it's a factor of production. Here's an indicator that it's not a factor of production. Every type of labor earns a positive return. We call that a wage. Okay? Every type of capital good earns a capital value, or a rent if it's hired out. Every natural resource earns rent. However, an entrepreneur can either earn a positive or a negative income. He can earn a positive profit or he can lose. Okay? But no other factor of production can earn a negative income. So entrepreneurial income is something different. It's not a return to a factor of production, otherwise it would have to be positive. Since it sometimes can be negative, it's a return to a decision. If the choice is correct or more correct than other choices being made by entrepreneurs, it's going to return something positive. If it's incorrect, then there'll be a loss. Okay. All right. Now, when we say that the entrepreneur determines or decides upon the employment of factors of production, what do we actually mean by that? We mean that he determines what to produce. Okay. What good to produce? Exactly what qualities that good will have? Where to produce it? What technology to use? There's many different ways to produce an automobile, for example. All the way from putting it together by hand, and some collectible automobiles can be built that way, or some luxury automobiles can be built that way, all the way to having a completely robotized factory, producing the car. So there's many different ways of doing it. The entrepreneur wants to choose the most cost-effective way. Now, given that he's undertaking an investment in factors of production, which have to be transformed eventually into a final consumer's good, it means that his decision, he will not know whether his decision is successful or not until some point in the future. It could be a year, it could be 5 years down the road, or even 10 years down the road. That means that entrepreneurs must anticipate future market conditions. Let's say GM wants to come up to develop a new model car, the supply and demand for that car today, or that type of car today, or something similar today, is not relevant. In fact, there might not be any similar type of product today. So prices today are some kind of a guide, but what he's interested in, what he must do, is to forecast or anticipate what supply and demand conditions are going to be 5 years from now when that car comes onto the market. Okay? So he's going to have to be able to really, at least on a general level, predict, or better yet, forecast what consumer value scales will be like and what competitors will be doing in the meantime. Okay. Now, what he must also do, since he has to pay his cost of production in advance, he pays the cost now, okay, or as the production process goes along, but he has to usually make a big fixed investment initially, he must compare that to estimated prices. So he must estimate what prices will be 5 years in the future, or 4 years in the future, or next month. In any case, It's the future prices of the output that are compared to the present prices or the cost of production. Okay? The present prices of the factors of production or the cost of production. Okay? So if you, when you add up all the prices of the factors of production, those are your costs. And that involves what we might call appraisement. Okay? He must place, appraisement means placing a cardinal number, okay, a price, deriving that from people's value scales, from available resources, and so on. And that's what the market does. The market continually generates, based on people's value scales, cardinal prices that can be used to calculate profits and losses. So the entrepreneur, knowing all of this qualitative information, that's not enough. Okay, he can know what demand's going to be in the future. He can know what supplies will be. He still has to have some cardinal number. He has to arrive at some cardinal number that he can compare to his cost of production. Okay. And he can be better or worse at forecasting future market conditions and appraising future market prices. If he's worse at it, he's going to lose money. If he's better at it than other entrepreneurs, no one's perfect at it, by the way. By the way, if every entrepreneur, let's get this straight now. If every entrepreneur knew perfectly what the prices of every good would be in the future, okay, what would happen to the prices of the factors of production today? If, for example, everybody knew that a certain type of automobile would sell for $30,000 in 2 years, what would the prices or the cost of producing that good be today? Well, everybody would rush in and they'd be willing to bid up to how much for the factors of production? Up to $30,000 minus the rate of interest over 2 years, okay? Because they're not getting paid for 2 years, so there's a time preference factor here, and that's reflecting the rate of interest. So it's the same as if I held up a $20 bill. If I held up a $20 bill right now, and I ask you, I'll sell it to the highest bidder, okay? Well, you're the entrepreneurs out there. The $20 bill is what you see in the future, okay? If everyone perfectly knew, if you trusted me, for example, if you didn't realize I was from New Jersey and my last name ended with a vowel, okay, and you trusted me that I would give you the $20 bill, what would you bid for that $20 bill? What would you predict right now would be the final bid? Very, very, very close to $20, okay? The person who would put the least amount of value on their time and effort of getting up out of their seat and coming up here might be $19.50, $19.75. Whatever it would be, okay? Well, that's what would happen. That's called the evenly rotating economy. We'll talk a little bit more why that's an important, though very unrealistic, and in fact, unrealizable construct, okay? We do assume sometimes that producers know, for certain problems in economics, producers know exactly what price will be in the future, okay? What that allows us to do is to show a world in which there's no uncertainty. And in that world, there is no profits. That's what I was getting at. Because every entrepreneur will bid, they'll all bid against one another, and they'll bid the prices of the cost of the factors of production up to the level of the future prices minus the interest rate. Okay? So, what that allows us to do, this construct which we call the evenly rotating economy, in which people's value scales are constant, resources are constant, and technology never changes, that allows us to separate two types of return that entrepreneurs tend to get. Their return as capitalists who advance their money now, and which is based on time preference, and their return as entrepreneurs who are operating under uncertainty. Right? So we look at a world where there's no change, and we find that there are no profits, which then tells us, we can deduce from that, that in fact profits come from uncertainty. They come from forecasting continual changes in supply and demand, okay, and being more right than other entrepreneurs in doing that. Okay. A few other things about entrepreneurs. Let me use an example. When Steve Jobs, who was one of the founders of Apple, when he began to make investments to bring his product to market, there were no personal computers on the market, or no small computers on the market that he could look to for prices. He had to appraise that future price of what this Mac, for example, would sell for. Based on his experience of the past, based on hunches about how businesses will react to a small computer and so on. And he did so in a way that was successful, okay, at least initially. Okay. Also, the entrepreneurial role implies that the person owns some capital. Okay? You know, it's not just a good idea. A lot of people have good ideas. Okay? You either have to have the capital necessary to put that idea into effect, or you have to go convince someone else that you have a good idea and get capital from that person. But usually in order to get backing, to get outside financial backing, you yourself need to put up some resources. Okay? You yourself have to risk something. Okay? So for the most part, entrepreneurs are also capitalists. That's why we call them capitalist entrepreneurs. Okay? Also, remember, since all production is for the future and you're paying the factors of production, land, labor, natural resources, in advance, okay, if you turn out to be wrong, you're the one who bears a sole loss. Okay? That is, you've already paid the costs. So think of it this way. When GM lost $10.6 billion last year, and we've brought this up, how much did the workers lose in producing the cars that were sold below cost? They lost nothing. They were paid in advance. They were paid every 2 weeks before the cars were actually produced. Now, as a result of those bad decisions, some of those workers may lose their jobs. But that has nothing to do with them getting paid for producing the goods that lost money. The entrepreneur bears the sole risk in production. And for the same reason, he gets whatever's left over after he is paid the factors of production. So he bears the sole risk. That is, sometimes he's called the residual claimant. He gets what's left over after all the factors have been paid. Yes?
Marx is like, I was reading, I think Marx is counter to von Bauer's idea, which he's discussing. And he said basically that, as he said, the laborers are exploited in the end because they get fired if any mishaps go along as far as a calculation,
right,
if the entrepreneur gets
right
lost. But that doesn't account for the labor they've already made, that they already got paid
right
for. So it's not, they're not losing any money because they labored and didn't get paid. They got
right
paid already.
Right.
So it's not exploitation.
Right. The laborer is may lose his or her job as a result of bad decisions by the entrepreneur. But the point is, during that production process, the labor got paid what he or she contributed to production. Okay. Now, by the way, when the labor gets laid off, the laborer labor is pretty nonspecific. The laborer can find another job. But the entrepreneur, and I'm not saying you should feel sorry for entrepreneurs that lose money. They've wasted scarce resources. They've produced the wrong things. But when they lose money, they've lost their capital. Okay. And they've lost their reputation. Okay. That is, it's going to be much more difficult to raise additional capital for another venture. Okay. All right. Now, let's just talk a little bit about the entrepreneur and the manager, because sometimes, especially in modern economy, it's difficult to pinpoint who the entrepreneur actually is. Okay. Or who the decision maker actually is. So let's look at the managerial function. Remember, the entrepreneur determines a general plan for the factors of production. But he knows that over time things may change, okay, and that, especially if it's a big firm that he creates, he can't take Bill Gates. He can't be everywhere to make small adjustments to these changes. So he hires managers, and managers are basically junior partners of the entrepreneur. Okay. In one way, they operate like entrepreneurs, but another very important way, they could never be called the entrepreneur. They may actually make day-to-day decisions, okay, day-to-day decisions about how the firm's operating. Okay. How does the entrepreneur oversee those decisions? Well, because of accounting, double-entry bookkeeping accounting, or double-entry accounting, the entrepreneur can evaluate the performance of every department, every division, okay, and the supervisors and so on. He can evaluate the manager's performance. And one way to motivate the managers is to make them part or people who share in the profits by giving them bonuses. That is, you can make their salary to some extent depend on bonuses, or by paying them partly in shares of stock. Okay, so the better they perform, the higher their bonuses are. However, why does this not supplant the entrepreneurial role? The worst that can happen to the managers is that they don't get a bonus. They still get a salary. They still get paid. They can be fired. What can't happen to the manager that can happen to the entrepreneur? Right. They can never lose money. They can never lose capital. Okay. They can participate in the profits, but they can't lose money. So, it's sort of like the following example. Let's say, let me get to someone who sort of criticizes this view, John Kenneth Galbraith, the left-wing economist, the late John Kenneth Galbraith, who just recently passed away in his 90s. He coined a term back in the 70s called the technocracy, meaning the scientists, engineers, and managers that sort of got together and wrested control of the firm effectively away from the stockholders and the entrepreneurs. And he claimed they ran it for their own benefit. Okay. And yes, they would just try to earn a small profit, as if it's easy to earn a profit of any size. They would earn a small profit to keep the stockholders happy, the entrepreneur investors happy, but they really control the firm for their own benefit. There's a number of things wrong with that. First of all, let me just give you an example that Murray Rothbard used to use, and that is, let's say, one of the Rockefellers, works in New York, and on weekends or a couple times a month goes up to his estate in upstate New York, okay? And he hires a head gardener or head landscaper who is in charge of landscaping the entire estate. Now, if you or I are observing this, we think this guy's completely in charge of everything. He's determining what sort of shrubbery to put in, what sort of grass to use, and so on. He's laying out the whole design of the estate, okay? It seems as if he controls it, but is he the ultimate decision maker? Of course not. One day, Rockefeller could come up there and say, "This is terrible. You're fired," and just get someone else, okay? And there's similar mechanisms that operate in the modern corporate firm, okay? For example, you have a board of directors that can fire the managers, okay? They represent the interests of the stockholders, okay? Yes, it's true the individual stockholders, though that's not true of the larger ones, but the small individual stockholders have really no knowledge of what's going on from day to day, nor do they have any sort of an incentive to collect all that information, because it's very costly to collect that information if they think there's something wrong, okay? It's very difficult to organize all these small stockholders. But there are some large stockholders that will always be looking over the shoulder of the managers. Okay, if they don't like something, especially if one of them sits on the board of directors, they can have them fired. There's also proxy fights where large stockholders will call for a vote on the board of directors, and they'll collect votes, proxies from smaller stockholders, and you can throw them out, the managers out that way, fire the board of directors. Put in new directors and new managers. But there's a way that even small stockholders can have a direct effect on the firm, on the policies that the managers are following if they don't like them. And that is simply voting with your feet. You can sell your stock. So if you think that the firm isn't performing very well, there'll be a mass movement of sales of stock on the stock market. So if the market... The total price of the firm on the stock market, okay, something like $8 billion, okay, and suddenly people become dissatisfied with the way the firm is being operated, and they start selling their stock, price of stock falls, so the firm's value falls, let's say it falls by 25% to $6 billion. That opens up the firm to a hostile takeover. Someone says, you know what, with the resources that firm controls, with the factors of production that are in effect that firm, I can buy it at $6 billion, and I believe I can increase profits in that firm to such an extent that stocks will rise by, let's say, 50%, and the value of the firm will be $9 billion. So that person will then launch a hostile takeover, and in the process, benefiting the remaining stockholders by bidding the prices up. So maybe he'll get the firm at $7 billion, bid the prices up, offer $7 billion for it, and then increase the profits, and as a result, bring about an increase in value, so let's say $9 billion. So that person would then earn a huge profit. This is called the market for corporate control. It happens all the time. When some firms merge with other firms, okay, they may do it, you know, in a way that's hostile. It might be a hostile takeover. Unfortunately, the Congress made it much harder to have hostile takeovers back in the 1960s. The Harrison Act. I don't know what the full name of that act is, but Senator Harrison was a crooked senator from New Jersey who got caught in Arab scam. Remember that scam where they had FBI agents dressed up as Arabs bribing some congressmen and senators. Okay, so he was caught up in that. But anyway, the law that was passed really benefited the managers, intended to entrench them more. And basically what it said was that you can't just go in and buy up the stock and take over the firm. You have to give notice that you're doing that. There's a certain waiting period. You can buy 10% of the stock after a certain period. So during that time, the managers know they have time to sort of get their house in order. Okay. So if you got rid of that, the market would operate even much more efficiently, and these managers would be very, very frightened of running the firm in a way that benefits themselves. Now remember, there are incentives to do that, right? Raising costs lowers the profits that consumers, that stockholders get, but benefits the managers. Because look, the managers would like to have a private Learjet at their disposal. They would like to have a chauffeur-driven limo, not just for themselves, but to bring their children to school. They would like to have access to expensive country clubs. They would like to hire two pretty secretaries instead of one efficient secretary. They would like to have very high-piled carpeting. Okay, and expensive art on the walls. What's to prevent them from doing all those things and raising costs? Okay, and lowering profit. That's an agency problem. Okay, where your agent is acting against your interests. Okay, yes, Mila.
Just in relation to all this, proxy fights are usually ineffective, like for the most part.
Right. Yeah, hostile takeovers are important. They're the most important. I mean, it's you know, proxy fights. I don't hear much about them anymore. Board of directors have become more vigilant over managers in the last decade or so. So that's become more effective. But you're right. You have to keep the market open. Okay, proxy fights aren't as effective as hostile takeovers. Yes.
So.
Yeah, it contributes. I would say this: laws inhibiting hostile takeovers contribute to corporate scandals. Yes. Yeah. It was interesting in the 1980s when we began to have this phenomenon of hostile takeovers. People were writing letters to the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and so on, saying things that, like, "This is a horrible thing. It's forcing American business to focus on short-term profits and short-term movements in the stock market, whereas Japanese managers can take the long-term view." Who are signing these letters? The existing managers of American firms that were targets for takeovers, the inefficient managers. The stock market represents what people think today, of the stream of profits in the future from the current managers. Okay, so it does reflect the long term. Okay, no one knows the long term for sure. So it reflects what people think of how that firm is being managed for now and for the long term, because the stream of profit is discounted into the price of the stock is a discounted stream of the firm's earnings. Okay, all right. Let's talk a little bit about profit and loss, because I've been using the term. And let me give you a very simple example. Okay, profit, which we'll represent as pi, is always equal to total revenue, okay, the number of units sold times the price per unit, minus total cost. Now, there's two different ways of defining cost. Okay, accountants define cost differently than economists do. So let me give you an example here. Let's say you have a small firm. It's a landscaping firm, and it's owned by a single individual. And in a given year, it returns $140,000 in monetary revenue, and the money costs that are laid out are $100,000. So the accountant, okay, forgetting about depreciation, the accountant would figure the net earnings or the profit of the firm at $40,000. That would be the accounting profit. Okay. The economist, however, would want to know more. The economist would want to know, has the owner contributed any resources to the firm that he himself owns? And if he has, they must have an imputed or implicit price assigned to them, okay, because they have an opportunity cost. They could be used in other lines of production on the market. So let's say that the owner manages the firm himself, okay? And let's then say, we then have to ask the question, what's the value of his managerial labor for the year? Well, it's the opportunity cost of that labor. He could, let's say, go to work for another small firm as a manager at $50,000, okay? That's the going rate, right? So let's say that what we call his implicit wages, okay, so implicit salary or whatever you want to call it, salary, okay, that's $50,000.
Am I off?
Yeah, I am. Let me do it over here. So implicit wages, let's say, $50,000. Okay. He also owns, a dump truck that he uses in the landscaping business. And that also has to have an opportunity cost, and that also has to be accounted for. And let's say he could lease that out, so there's an implicit rent. He could lease it out for $5,000, okay? So there's implicit rent. So that resource that he contributes is worth $5,000. And finally, let's assume that he finances the business himself. That is, he pays he has $100,000 of capital himself. He doesn't have to borrow. But yet, there is an opportunity cost of the capital invested, and that is what he could have earned, let's say, on a risk-free certificate of deposit. So let's say, for simplicity, he could have earned, how much do I figure here? Let's make it simple, he could have earned 10%. So that's $10,000 of foregone interest. Okay, so that's implicit or foregone interest. Okay, now, adding that into the out-of-pocket cost, it's another $65,000 of implicit costs that represent the opportunity costs of the resources that he contributes to the firm. So an economist would calculate profit, okay, total cost $165,000, total revenue $140,000, as equal to negative $25,000. He's actually lost money. Now, is that meaningful? People will often say, well, that's not, he didn't really lose that. Well, yeah, he did, in a meaningful sense, in a sense that affects his actions. That is, if he had to do over again, what he would have done was this. He would have gone to work for another firm for $50,000. He would have leased his truck out to someone else for $5,000. And he would have left his money in the certificate of deposit at 10%. At the end of the year, he would have had his full $100,000 in principal, and he would have had $65,000 in income from the resources that he owned. He would have had, in effect, what? $165,000. So he has lost money. He has not earned any sort of pure profit. Now, what if instead of total revenue being $140,000, it was $165,000? Then we would say that he earned a normal rate of return on all his resources, including his capital. But he did not earn any what? Did not earn any profit. Even though he earned $10,000 on the $100,000 investment, that's an interest return. Okay? That's the result of time preference. He hasn't earned anything here. There's no extra revenue left over that would indicate that he has moved lower valued resources to higher value uses. Okay, which is now the ultimate source of now. If it was more, if he earned $200,000, then the $35,000 over and above all implicit costs and the capital that he invested, that would be pure profit. Yes. I'm just hypothetically saying, let's say he owns a truck. To the extent that people own resources, including their own labor and capital that they contribute, what I'm saying is that you cannot just look at the out-of-pocket costs. You have to look at the value of all resources used. Okay? Let me, I think a very good example of how, or the social function of, and the source of profit. Okay, now, very quickly, the source of profit is the fact that some of these resources are being used in lower valued uses from the point of view of consumers. Okay, so if he earns $200,000, then what he's done is taken resources worth $165,000 and found a better use for them. He's bid against other entrepreneurs for these various things, for the labor, for the tools that are used in his operations, for the gasoline and so on, and he's moved them to maybe he's got a different idea about how to landscape, and so he's put this idea into effect, and it's more valuable to consumers. If he hadn't stepped in, resources would have been wasted. And so that's the social function of profit. And the example I want to give you, we have it here, yeah. It's actually a marvelous example of a great entrepreneur, or a stroke of entrepreneurial genius by this woman that used to work for IBM. Now, this was a woman, her name is Tamima Edmark, okay, who invented something that allowed women to, I guess, braid their hair or make ponytails and so on. It was called Topsy Tail, okay? It's a very simple implement. She became a millionaire as a result of it. So let me read you a little bit of this article. It was August of 1989, and Tamima Edmark was a Dallas-based IBM mainframe saleswoman. Good thing she got out of that. And she thought her long blonde ponytail looked a little drab. Edmark found she could braid her ponytail by using a makeshift device consisting of a plastic loop, okay, and a knitting needle, okay. Figuring she was onto something with her hair gadget, Edmark, then 32, plunked down $5,000 to patent what she called Topsy Tail. Okay. She called on a company in New Jersey, and a couple companies in New Jersey to help her make and market this product. They turned her down. Okay. So she decided to make it herself. She paid for a mold with $9,000 in savings. She was still working for IBM at the time. She found a plastics maker who would produce as many Topsy Tails as she needed for about 50 cents a piece. Okay, so they're at about 50 cents a piece, plus you have to, you know, allocate some of the overhead, $9,000 in mold to that. So she's making them for 60, 70 cents a piece, whatever it was. Then she started advertising in a small hairstyling magazine. The first ad, which was in April 1991, brought in orders worth $1,000. Okay, and she would fill them herself, stuffing these Topsy Tail things into envelopes at home at night after work. By the end of 1991, she was moving 200 units a month at $10 each. Okay? They're costing her 60, 70 cents. She's selling them at $10 each now. While in New York on IBM Business, she persuaded Glamour magazine editor, it's a big woman's fashion magazine, the editor was named Melissa Fedor, to try Topsy Tail. Okay? Within 3 weeks, it was then featured in a February 1992 issue. Within 3 weeks, Edmark had $100,000 worth of orders and had to enlist her cleaning lady to help her stuff 400 envelopes each week. She got a big break, however, when IBM fired her, okay, along with three-quarters of their Dallas mainframe sales office. Okay, she had a $25,000 early retirement package, and she lived off this money while she began hawking her product to retailers. She had gone to trade shows and hair salons, but that was small time. Okay, she had her own promotional video. But she did find out that the sales dramatically increased whenever women saw how easy the plastic device was to use. Okay, so she wanted to make a television commercial. Okay, after several false starts, she found a small TV products firm in New Jersey that promoted things like kitchen gadgets and sunglasses. Okay. The company agreed to put together a 2-minute commercial, manage Topsy Tail's television marketing and print advertising and retail distribution. So the company was going to do all that. All Edmark had to do was appear in the commercial and sell them enough product at a price reputed to be about a dollar a piece to meet the demand. So her cost was a dollar, and so that's what she was going to do. So the strategy worked. On her own, Edmark had sold 250,000 Topsy Tails at $10 a piece in 20 months. Okay. Remember, that was costing her less than a dollar, so she's already making a lot of money. In the first 6 months after her commercial hit the networks, in December 1992, she sold $3.6 million at about $15. Okay, And let's see what her costs were. The costs were down to 22 cents. And she sold them at $15 a piece. Okay, 3.6 million. You do the math. She's a multimillionaire. Okay. What did she do? She took a piece of plastic and a knitting needle that was worth 22 cents in other functions that entrepreneurs are only willing to pay 22 cents for, consumers in general, and she combined them in a new way and turned them into something that was worth to consumers $15. Okay. That's the entrepreneurial profit right there. Okay. She paid what entrepreneurs are paying. She didn't lowball anybody. She went out and bought what these factors of production, combined them in a different way according to a different idea, and sold them for a price much above the per unit cost. Okay, that's where her profit came from. Okay, that's where all profits come from. That's just an extreme example, which I think is a very good example. Profits come from continually readjusting production, using factors of production in new and novel ways. And they can be the same factors. You don't have to have the new technology. She didn't have any new technology, okay? Which is a better, it was just a new idea about how to combine these factors. So to continually adjust production to forecast changes in consumer demand. She had a forecast that there were many women out there that were like her and that wanted something very quick in the morning, working women, that would enable them to do their hair in a way that was simple, quick, but looked good. And she was right. Yes?
Just on the landscape example, let's say that's like year one, right?
Right.
So in year one, you made an incorrect entrepreneurial decision as far as year one is concerned because he could put his resources into more profitable uses. But what if at year two, year three, the total revenue starts increasing beyond the initial total cost? So you say during that time he made correct entrepreneurial decision.
Right. The question is, what would happen if the person lost money in the first year, and many startup businesses do lose money in the first couple of years, but then his business caught on and he began to earn pure profits after that? Well, that's just the cost of doing business. He forecasts that eventually it's going to take a while before his reputation is built up and that therefore he will earn entrepreneurial profits. So he forecasts correctly. Okay. Let me just end with this example. I'll take some questions. Real world examples. Does anyone remember the Blair Witch Project, that movie? That was made for $40,000. And the total revenue that it generated was, do I have that here? I have the figures for it somewhere. Yeah, let's see. Yeah, it was made for $60,000. It generated $50 million worth of revenues, okay? They were, the people who made it hired unknown actors. They used a very cheap setting in Maryland, okay? And they used a technique, these shaky handheld cameras that were cheap but worked very well for the movie. And there was a couple millions more spent on advertising they got some firm to advertise for them, but they still made millions and millions of dollars. The other example I wanted to give is The Passion of Christ, which was, you know, a picture made by Mel Gibson that people claimed, oh, you know, it's not going to make any money. There was huge criticisms of it. He made it for $40 million. I saw him on, I think he said 40, maybe it would come to a little bit more than that. And worldwide, it garnered $500 million in revenues. Okay. So did he exploit anybody? No, he simply took resources that anybody could have purchased, cameras and actors and so on, and combine them in a different way, in a way that better satisfied consumer wants than anything else that was out there at the time. Now, somebody could have come out with probably even a better movie that somebody could have made that would have attracted people away from his movie. But the point is that the world isn't perfect. People are making mistakes. As long as you're better than the other entrepreneurs, you're going to earn profit. Okay. I'll stop here. There's a few other things I'll say in the next lecture about this. But I'll take some questions. We have about 5 minutes. Questions? Comments? You're making me cold. Okay, thank you.